this is it, edition number 4 of Cinema Squabble. You can find us at cinemasquabble.com. Cinema Squabble, what is this? This is a podcast. We've put together a number of Seattle movie critics. We've gotten together for years in movie theaters discussing what's happening in cinema, but now we bring it to you in podcast form. My name's Adam Gerke, and joining me at the table is Sarah Michelle Fetters from the Seattle Gay News, also moviefreak.com. We've got Mike Ward here from shouldiseeit.net, and Brian Zitzelman from The Examiner.
Hey, hey.
All right. This is the edition where we've got all the Oscar picks. We've got all the exciting things you need to know about this weekend. Get your office pool ready and jot down your notes for that on how you're going to make this.
We want to help you gamble.
Right. Legally or not legally.
Not, yeah, legally.
We can shift the Vegas odds just yes. with what we say.
Right. So we've got Oscar information. We've also got McFarland USA to talk about, Hot Tub Time Machine 2 to talk about, The Duff, and What We Do in the Shadows. So before we get to our Oscar picks, let's talk a little bit about what's out on film this weekend specifically. And we'll start with...
Opening in the Seattle area.
Oh, well, sure.
Oh,
yeah.
Almost assuming.
I think actually all of these are opening in the Seattle area, maybe with the exception of one. But Hot Tub Time Machine number 2. Now, if you're not familiar entirely with what Hot Tub Time Machine is all about, it's, I mean, the self-descripting name right there, and it tells you. A bunch of guys who are all high school buds. Originally got in a hot tub a couple of years ago. It took them on a
five years ago,
a mind-bending tour of time and examining how the choices they made impacted their future. And so they go back in time, they go forward in time. Well, they're taking another dip in the tub this time around to try and... but this one sends them 10 years into the future and all things are awry. So trying to square away...
In 2025.
Yeah. So it sends them into the future and trying to straighten out their lives one more time. That brings us to, well, pretty much where we're at. Directed by Steve Pink and writer Josh Harold, who wrote the last Hot Tub Time Machine. And
both of whom are returning, yes.
Both returning.
The entire cast, other than Adam Scott, all returning.
And
well, there's one noticeable absence, but we can talk about that in just a second.
Yeah. So, well, actually, well, let's just talk about it right now. Let's just give it right on the nose. We're missing none other than John Cusack, who was...
Yeah. He was Adam.
Adam, and he's integral to the last...
He's the main character.
Yeah, so we're kind of absent of Adam the entire film here.
Has the character been replaced?
Kind of. Okay. So here's the thing. So why John Cusack isn't in the film, nobody really wants to talk about.
Mm-hmm.
And for a while there, it looked like the sequel wasn't going to happen because John Cusack isn't part of the film. It's very interesting that for an actor that decided not to be a part of the film, the entire movie is about his character.
And
everything that happens in this movie is because of John Cusack's character, who is not in it at all, and ends up revolving around his son, Adam Jr., played by Adam Scott.
And we'll just...
A lot of Adams.
And should point out that a lot of the humor actually is right on the nose, and they break the fourth wall in this multiple times, basically addressing the camera like, we're actually saying this. This is actually happening.
Well, it's the 22 Jump Street of Hot Tub Time Machine movies.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, jeez. Hold on.
Okay, so I've got a question for the two of you. Mm. Did you both like the first one? Where are we at on the first one?
I enjoyed the first one.
Mm-hmm. Adam?
I did too. I enjoyed it probably more than I should have.
Okay, so then how about the second one?
Kind of the same deal. I enjoyed it a little bit more than I should have. Oddly, it feels like the schizophrenic second cousin to the SpongeBob movie that's currently playing right now, because they're almost the exact same film in how they look at humor, they're set up, how
Who's
they're
playing
plotted.
Patrick?
In that anything and everything can happen at any moment, and they're so fast-paced and so all over the map that you almost need ADD medicine to keep track of everything that's happening.
Wonderful.
And I would say if your 13-year-old, your inner 13-year-old is alive and well right now, your older you will enjoy this as well.
Well,
so
my question, I'm an 8-year-old who loved the SpongeBob movie, so the themes will transcend. I should just shotgun both of those and take her to the movies on Saturday.
Probably because there's a little bit more penis in this one.
Well, you know, we grow up
a little bit more.
Yeah. No, but you know, there's more
penis. What an amazing comparison though, by the way.
Yeah,
I never expected.
There's more penis in this movie than there was in 50 Shades of Grey last week.
You're absolutely right.
Which is kind of ironic if you think about it.
Yeah.
So you said there's a lot of jokes. Amazing. What's the hit rate? What's the ratio? Roughly.
Depend on your sensibility. For me, it was about 4 out of 10.
Okay.
Which isn't great, but the 4 that were funny, I laughed out loud. So I have to kind of give that I have to bump that up the scale just a little bit because I don't usually laugh out loud at a film.
Yeah.
And so even though I found most of the jokes falling flat, when they hit hard.
Mm-hmm. I would say the same. I would, you know, you want in comedies, you want those laughs fast and furious. You want them coming at least a laugh out loud every 2 minutes if you can achieve it. I don't think this gets every 2 minutes, but
not
I will. But I will say what was funny is Sarah at the screening that you and I were at. There's that certain part about comedies when there's the audience laughed and it happens and it's this kind of this rise and fall. And usually you hope that the fall happens long enough that you as an audience are now able to hear the next line, right? It's that pause for laughter. And so that happened last night in one particular, I don't even remember what the joke was. The laughter from the audience happens, it descends, and from the back of the theater, louder than everything else, you hear a woman...
That was funny.
Which fantastic. Created it. It created its own crescendo of laughter throughout the studio.
She's a plant.
Well,
she might have been. There is, yeah. I have to say, there is a great bit in the center of the film where they have fast forwarded in 2025 and Clark Duke, who's returning as Rob Corddry's son, has to explain what's going on. And they start comparing everything to the Terminator films and mm-hmm. to Back to the Future. Mm-hmm. It's hysterical. It's witty, it's smart, and it also shows just the utter idiocy mm-hmm. of all of this.
So where are you guys sitting on this?
Given the fun things that you have to do this weekend, if you're up to speed on all your Oscar picks and all that, I would say theater for me on this one. Or a rental, but a matinee at that.
Wow, that was really...
Right in the fence.
I know that. I don't know if that could have been any more definitive there.
I'm the fence rider.
Sarah?
No, it's a solid rent. I mean, it's not a very good movie, but I laughed. It's hard for me to get too angry at the movie because I did laugh, but mm-hmm. it's not great. If you're going in expecting Steve Pink to be doing another Gross Point Blank, you're going to be sadly, sadly disappointed. Yes. Yeah, but if you're going in expecting Hot Tub Time Machine 2, which, you know... It's a Hot Tub Time Machine movie. Mm-hmm. You're going to get exactly what you expect. So mm-hmm. it's a solid rental, nothing more.
Mm-hmm. So we have one theater and one matinee, or one theater matinee and one rent. At this
we are breaking
point.
It down. Yeah, like theater matinee. Come on.
Theater
one
or rent.
IMAX, but
theater
not IMAX
or rent.
3D.
I think that's Adam's half star.
No,
right?
Theater or rent. Come on.
Theater or rent.
What sure. is okay. what is it?
Well, for me, it'll be a theater then.
All right.
Purely on the fact that
don't
I think
coward.
I think it can. This can be a theater film purely on the fact that if you're already up to speed with everything else, this is a fun escape for the weekend.
You are just going to keep riding that fence no matter what I try to do to you.
You bet I am.
All right.
So also now talking about what we do in the shadows. Mr. Ooh. Brian.
So this is a movie that comes from New Zealand of all places. And it might be familiar to some people. It comes from Jemaine Clement and Taika Waititi. They actually did Eagle vs. Shark. Jemaine Clement's kind of well known not locally, but domestically speaking.
Well, he has been here for SIFT.
Domestically speaking, he's from Flight of the Conchords. And these two comedians have kind of been the only imports we've had from New Zealand other than Peter Jackson. And it's a mockumentary, I guess you'd say, in the vein of Spinal Tap and the Christopher Guest movies. And mm-hmm. it's just a bunch of vampires, some extremely old, like a Nosferatu type, mm-hmm. some kind of younger, trying to stay hip. And it's just hijinks. They are followed around by a camera crew. They never establish the reason why. It's not really important. It's just an excuse for a series of jokes to come about, like, you know, vampires discover Google. And there's a scene where there's a great scene where they're like, someone teaches them technology and it's like, here, you can Google whatever you want, images, and they Google virgins because they like to have virgin's blood, of course. And Jemaine Clement's character goes, I don't think a virgin would do that.
Can I also add one moment?
Yeah, I know, Mike, you saw the movie, so.
This rules. I was ecstatic watching this. Glorious, laughing tears, the whole thing. It's though, the scene you're talking about,
yes.
the premise of the movie, it doesn't matter that it's the found footage mockumentary, like you said. It makes no sense. They do title cards to explain why they're doing it and that they were given special crucifixes to wear to protect
yes,
them
yes.
so they could complete the project. But the scene right after they're trying to use cell phones, they're learning about Google. They want to see a picture of a sunrise and they just all sit in there just like, oh, There's scenes where they're trying to integrate into modern life. So one of the vampires is taking karate lessons. I mean, this thing just soars.
Are there any good songs, though? That's what I want to know. Are there good songs?
Well, Brett McKenzie is not a part of this. Oh, he's the other Flight of the Conchord. So you're hoping that they'll reunite, but no, there's no music.
Yeah. I mean, the gags are all kind of obvious, but they're all rather clever. Like they play up the standard tropes, like vampires can't enter a place unless they've been invited in. So they find a hot new club.
Yes.
They want to go in, but they can't. And the bouncer's like, what's going on, guys? Like, would you like to invite us in?
I don't want to throw hyperbole out here, but this is easily the most fun I've had with a movie all year.
No kidding.
It is, but it is
supremely funny.
Dry European British humor. So if that is not, I mean, there are sight gags and there are a lot of puns, but some of the humor is sandpaper dry. So if that is not your cup of tea,
isn't it dry Kiwi humor?
It would be dry Kiwi humor.
But I think I know where you guys are going on this one. I'm just going to hazard a guess that we're going to be kind of positive.
It's a very hard theater.
Mm-hmm. Oh, absolutely. Good luck finding it, though, but there's an alternative.
But there is an alternative. I mean, I think you should see it in the theater because I think there's always the fun of seeing something that's got a big pop to it with a big crowd, but it is available on VOD, so you can rent it at home. So that is definitely an option if it's not playing somewhere close to you right now.
It was playing in New York in one theater last week, and it drew this like massive audience the whole weekend.
Sold
so people are into it. So
okay, so Mike, you're saying theater?
Absolutely.
Brian,
theater,
you're saying
what
theater.
We do in the
so
shadows.
Two See theaters, it. What we do in the shadows. Brings us to The Duff.
Yes, The Duff, our teen rom-com hybrid movie of the weekend.
What does The Duff stand for?
The Duff is actually an anagram for designated ugly fat friend. And I will tell you, when you try to tell people about this movie, that's the first question they ask.
And they get incredibly offended.
They do. And I know firsthand, talking with one of the reps that has to try to work this movie in our community, the question comes up all the time. He spends so much time running circles around trying to explain, no, listen, this is okay. No, I'll explain. Mm-hmm. And then he has to give parts of the movie away. He's as frustrated with this as anybody. But what The Duff is about is you have this girl, Bianca, played by Mae Whitman, who has been a supporting character in, gosh, lots of things. You probably would, if you saw The Perks of Being a Wallflower, she had a key part in that.
Yeah, she was in
Beautiful film.
Arrested Development. I know she was on
Parenthood. Well, Arrested Development the last season. So this is her first chance at sort of headlining a film. And she plays Bianca, who is just kind of she just kind of marches to the beat of her own drummer. She has two friends, her best friends, Casey and Jess, and they are, the popular girls. They look perfect, hair, makeup, all that. Mm-hmm. So I think they're at a party and she ends up talking with her best friend from like her childhood best friend, Wesley, who's the captain of the football team. And he throws out, well, you're the Duff, right? She has no idea what he's talking about. What is a Duff? So he explains, you're the designated ugly fat friend. Everyone has one. And then she gets offended. He tries to clean it up. She gets more offended. He does a bad job. And from there, what we end up having is her attempting to sort out why she's classified this way. She tries to, figure out how to make things, how to change this so she is no longer viewed that way. She ends up sort of enlisting Wesley, or I guess Wesley sort of enlists her, and they end up sort of forming this connection, and it goes from there.
So what are we looking at for, this is clearly like a high school teen comedy. Is this more in the line of like Mean Girls Heathers, where it's like very kind of
if you look at this movie, it wants to be Mean Girls.
Okay.
It does.
It wants very, very badly to be Mean Girls, but it has a plot that's basically She's All That.
And I would say
it's better than She's All
terrible.
That. No, but it's actually pretty good. It's better than She's All That, but it's not Mean Girls.
And it
can't follow through on a lot of what it's going for.
And I will say that some of the writing and some of the humor and the speed which it comes at you is very reminiscent of Juno.
Yes.
And we actually look back to what Ellen Page's character did in Juno.
Does it have the heart of Juno?
Yes, actually.
Surprisingly.
Yeah. Mike?
Yeah, I would agree. The chemistry between Mae Whitman and then the actor Robbie Amell, who plays Wesley, is
fantastic.
Actually really great. And she can have chemistry with all of these different characters. Mm-hmm. She's the takeaway from this because she has to interact with
Mae Whitman.
Mae Whitman, the popular kids, the kids that sort of are the misfit you know, toys sort of a kid. And she has to interact with all these different characters, and she's brilliant at it.
Well, what's great also is the movie's very upfront about what it is and who it is and where it's going. It doesn't back away from talking about the anagram. It doesn't back away from talking about how kids fit in a high school clique structure. It's not shy on that front.
But is that something that's more stereotypical? I mean, high schools have their variations of cliques, but I mean, is it more of an authentic clique kind of thing, or is it more movies literally the football players are all walking down the...
Okay. Yes and no. I mean, it's a hard one for me to sit there and say, you're wrong, but you're wrong.
No, I haven't seen it. I don't know that's if I'm what wrong. I mean. It's like,
no, you are. I mean, you are wrong, even though you're not wrong, if that makes any sense.
No, yeah. But...
And yes. One of the, I think, Mike, what you're to your point, one of the fun takeaways, indeed, is May, purely in the fact that it seems like a lot of what she's doing is improv, or they've kind of let her cut loose, and in some ways she strikes me as a very young Melissa McCarthy.
But the thing with Mae Whitman and Robbie Amell and Bianca and Wesley is they are actually playing three-dimensional characters in this film. Mm-hmm. Their relationship is believable. It's authentic. You do get an understanding of who they were, not only as children, but who they are as high school seniors, which makes everything else work. And also, we got to give a little bit of a shout out to Bella Thorne, who mm-hmm. plays the villainess of the piece, Madison, who's the, you know, she is the mean girl. She mm-hmm. is the plastic one. It's completely one-dimensional character. She's just there to be the thorn in everybody's sign. Haha, Bella Thorne. But she does it perfectly.
Now, Mike, you're the one with the teen daughter.
Yes.
Did she go with you? Or?
Yeah. I was able to see this with her and a number of her friends. It was interesting watching this because the film, the one problem... It's jarring in its tone. It shifts from being kind of raunchy and you feel like it's trying to push the edge, and then it comes back to trying to be a movie with a lot of heart. So I'm watching this and I'm kind of just like all over the map trying to sort through all this, and they are just captivated. You know, they're laughing at all the right moments. They're snickering back and forth to each other. They're throwing the popcorn with the eyes wide open. They had a great time with this. And I kind of, because, you know, being a film critic, I, you know, ask way too many questions of my kids when they watch movies. My 8-year-old can especially speak to that.
What do they think of
But what did you think of the mise-en-scène in SpongeBob? You know, that kind of question. But so I was kind of like, well, what about this? What about that? And they were just like on point with everything. They enjoyed it. And, you know, I don't think my daughter's seen Mean Girls, but this will be the buy-in to that for her, you know, because it kind of introduces her to this stuff. And, you know, she had a great time with it. They all did.
Okay, on that, Sarah, voting on this one, theater, rent, skip?
If it followed through in the last 30 minutes, it would be theater. Because it kind of undercuts itself in the last 30 minutes, it's going to be a strong rent.
Okay, and Mike?
I'm going to agree exactly with what Sarah said.
Okay.
It's a rent.
I'm going to back you on that as well as a rent. I think the film did more than I expected, but to be honest... It's a CBS film, and CBS films often play as after-school specials to me, and that doesn't make it necessarily bad,
right.
But it doesn't necessarily put it in the pocket to me as something I want to go spend my money on. So three strong rents from us on The Duff. That brings us to McFarland, USA. Sarah, you want to set this up for us?
McFarland, USA is Disney back in inspirational, true-life sports story terrain, a la Miracle, The Rookie... Remember the Titans and all of those films. This one has Kevin Costner as a high school athletic coach who comes to the small California town of McFarland to be an assistant on their football team and ends up realizing they need cross country and they need it now because of all the migratory Hispanic students that are in the school. As a side point, it is a true story. The gentleman that Costner's playing, Jim White, went on to win 9 state championships in California in 14 years. Mm-hmm. Say that again. 9 state championships starting in 1987.
Yeah.
In 14 years.
Yeah. And
it's incredible.
In addition to the fact, I mean, I ran cross country in high school, and I know how unsexy a sport it can be because you're going up and down hills for miles, and people are literally throwing up around you. And sometimes it's you because you're running yourself to the point of exhaustion. And yet somehow they take that unglamorous sport and turn it into the film that we see here. And I walk away. I say this film had a lot of heart to it, as predictable as Disney can be with their sports films. I mean, we know where this is going. at the very end, I am sitting in my chair quietly cheering, going, go, 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 Danny, yeah. go.
You but know? That's the great thing about this film. And I think all kudos. Yes, the script, which is kind of a, it's got a cavalcade of writers. Mm-hmm. Christopher Cleveland has the most to do with it, but there were a lot of writers that were involved with getting this one out there. The kudos for this have to go to Nikki Cairo. Mm-hmm. She's the director that made Whale Rider a few years back that got mm-hmm. a bunch of Oscar nominations. Fantastic film. One of the, it's a Kiwi coming of age story. New Zealand, sorry. We'll go back to New Zealand again. Hey, everything comes back, full circle today. We're back to New Zealand. Yeah. But, I mean, if you haven't seen Whale Rider, you need to go watch it right now. It's one of the best films from the, you know, the last decade. She does an outstanding job directing this film because she gives you a sense of time and of place and of character mm-hmm. and of ethnicity that a lesser director would not have given this movie. They would have just made it a straight ahead period piece. And instead, she makes this menu come alive.
Is there any issue, having not seen the movie myself, when you bring up ethnicity? I mean, this is still also another movie about minorities where the main character's a white character. Is that troublesome at all in the movie? Does it handle it well?
In this case, it did not trouble me because most of the Hispanic runners are three-dimensional characters. It does not shortchange any of the people that are on this team.
Yeah. And I will say to that Kevin Costner as the coach role, I mean, second to none. I don't know anybody else who plays a coach or who has played the role of the coach, you know, quite like he has for how many years? How many sports films has he done? I mean, we were talking about that earlier, too.
A lot.
So, I mean, realistically.
But he's usually been the athlete. And then, you know, with Draft Day, he transitioned to being the behind the scene guy. And now he's a coach.
Draft Day podcast is back again.
No more Draft Day. This is the finest Costner movie, I think, in a while. I was really impressed with it. And, you know, Sarah's right. The characters that, you know, a lesser film would just sort of trot these people out and it would all be about Kevin Costner. We'd have $1 million arm again where mm-hmm. the focus is shifted to the wrong place, right? The things we care about aren't featured. And they're front and center in this. They all get stories. I would say that there's one character, Danny, he kind of steals the movie.
Diaz is awesome.
And the actor, I'm not familiar with this, Ramiro Rodriguez is his name. And he doesn't have a lot of lines.
Right.
And he has a certain distinctive look about him that sort of makes you sort of root for him.
He's magnetic.
He steals the film. And mm-hmm. it's those kind of things that make it a little more special than the list of films that Sarah kind of ran off where Disney's just kind of trotting through their sports, you know, films. So it works.
A lot of people are trying to make this out to be, you know, the 2015 version of Hoosiers. I don't think it's that good. I don't think we can put it in that category. Now ask me this question again in a decade, I might change my mind.
Okay, so let's call it at that. Sarah, you're saying theater on this?
Strong theater. Easily the best thing I've seen so far this year.
Okay, and Mike, how about
from a major studio.
Yeah.
Okay, good. theater.
Theater, and I'm going to back you guys on that. So we got three theaters.
Is this a theater or like a matinee?
No.
Where are we going?
Is there popcorn? Yeah. Or we know popcorn?
Bring in your own popcorn on that.
Okay, well, there we go.
Microwave it beforehand.
Exactly.
Got it.
Yes. Wear the padded jacket and bring it in yourself. Yeah. So, okay. So three in the theater for McFarland, USA this weekend. Which brings us to something we've been kind of teasing at for quite some time, and that is the Oscar race. Sarah, you think there's something special about this year's Oscar race. Tell us what you think that is.
This is definitely one of the more intriguing Oscar years in a long time, and only just because the usual metrics, the way that you can anticipate and figure out and predict the Oscars mm-hmm. are completely out the window. And that mainly relates to Best Picture and how it pertains to both Birdman and to Boyhood. Mm-hmm. And the only reason I say that it's just so weird and so out of unusual is early on we had Boyhood taking home a lot of awards and a lot of prizes that would lead you to believe it would become the eventual Best Picture winner. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't so much that it was winning critics' prizes, it was that it was also winning Fringe Indie Award prizes, it was winning the Golden Globe, it won the BAFTA. It won things that led you to believe it was the strong front runner. And then all of a sudden, the guild groups came in, meaning the Screen Actors Guild, the Directors Guild, the Writers Guild, and the Producers Guild, and they started giving everything to Birdman. Mm-hmm. We've never had a case where two films have split everything in that fashion, mm-hmm. where the guilds have gone one way and everybody else has gone the other. And that makes it an unusual, bizarre little weird mm-hmm. year to try and do predicting mm-hmm. because of that.
The only thing I can think of in the years that I've kind of been an avid Oscar watcher and, you know, sort of trying to make predictions, this sort of reminded me for a while, like the Social Network King's Speech year. So you have the Social Network just running away with this race right at this point. You know, you've got Guilds and the Critics' Choice, and it's winning all the December Critics Prizes. Social Network is custom made. Here we go. David Fincher's finally going to get his Oscar. And then here comes the King's Speech at the 11th hour, and it kind of, I think it wins SAG. It wins a couple other little prizes that people sort of throw aside, and yeah, it's still Social Network's race. And what wins the Best Picture? The King's Speech. Mm-hmm. But in this instance, Boyhood, which was on the ropes, being knocked out by Birdman and through every major guild, it wins BAFTA.
And what is BAFTA for those who
are British, the British Academy Film Awards.
Okay. Yeah, yeah.
It's not so much that as just the history of the Oscars. When you try to figure out voting patterns and how the Academy figures itself out and how they actually vote for things, there are patterns that arise. And if you win the BAFTA and you win the SAG and you win the LA Film Critics, you're going to win the Oscar. If you win...
A lot of those have been going by the wayside lately, though. I mean, they really... some of the smaller ones. I mean, if you
this
get
year,
SAG, directors, and PGA, the Producers Guild, you tend to still win the same thing. The last
this has
film
never
to win those
happened.
Three, the last one to win those three... and not win Best Picture was Apollo 13. So
yes.
It's been a while.
Yeah. Yeah, but Apollo 13 didn't win a lot of the other stuff. So you were so it was easy to sit there and be able to say this was not going to happen. The way everything lined up this year has never happened before.
Okay. So on that thought, let's dig into some of the nominees. Let's start with the supporting actors and actresses right now. So in actress in a supporting role, we've got Patricia Arquette for Boyhood, Laura Dern in Wild, Keira Knightley with The Imitation Game, Emma Stone in Birdman, and Meryl Streep Into the Woods. Who do we think that the Oscar's actually going to go to?
I think this one's a pretty solid lock that Patricia Arquette's winning.
Yeah,
I mean,
Patricia
she's won
Arquette.
Basically everything.
I think okay. We all agree on that. Yeah. Patricia Arquette's going to win.
Okay, so we're saying the Academy's going that way. Anybody else in dissension of that?
Yes. Yeah. I mean, fairly decent. I mean, I think Patricia Arquette has some really good scenes in Boyhood, but I do think there's some that she doesn't totally nail. Some that's a little bit the writing. Some that's just other little things. I know my personal pick for this would kind of go against some other people here, particularly... I would go with Laura Dern for Wild. I know she has a smaller part, but I think it's quintessential to the themes of the movie.
It's too
how
bad
it impacts the main character. It's pretty terrific.
It's too bad she was better in The Fault in Our Stars.
She really wasn't. That movie was garbage. Oh.
Very, very true.
Take a knee.
Okay. I know what you're talking about. I'm not taking a knee.
All right. So we're saying Patricia Arquette, I think, pretty much is the vote around the table here otherwise. So now looking at actor in a supporting role, Robert Duvall in The Judge, Ethan Hawke, Boyhood, Edward Norton in Birdman, Mark Ruffalo in Foxcatcher, and J.K. Simmons, Whiplash. Who do we think the Academy's saying...
J.K. Simmons is going to win.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And he's going to talk too long, and the band will play him off, and he'll do the Not My Tempo thing. That's exactly what's going to happen.
You hope so.
Yeah. Anybody else who has dissension to this? Are you guys thinking anybody else?
As in,
do we want? Or?
Well, who would you want out of this list here?
I'd want Mark Ruffalo to win. Mm-hmm. I think Mark Ruffalo is the heart and soul of Foxcatcher. I think he gives a brilliant performance, maybe his best ever. And he is not even going to come close to winning, because if there is an upset, it's going to be Edward Norton.
Mm. Yeah, I agree completely. J.K. Simmons is my choice. He was my choice the moment Whiplash ended, before nominations even were rolled out, obviously. But, you know, I can make a case for Edward Norton and Ethan Hawke and Ruffalo. Duvall, you know, I don't
Why
understand
Why is Duvall
that,
nominated again?
It's J.K. Simmons.
Yeah, I say it's... Yeah, and I'm agree with you on that. Okay, so looking to actress in a leading role. We've got Marion Cotillard for 2 Days, One Night. One of Brian's favorites this year.
Love it.
Yeah.
Yes.
Also, Felicity Jones in The Theory of Everything, Julianne Moore in Still Alice, Rosamund Pike in Gone Girl, and Reese Witherspoon, Wild. Who do we think the Academy is taking this one?
It's another no-brainer. Julianne Moore is going to win.
Yeah, it's pretty safe. She's won pretty much everything so far. There's the whole career achievement thing, which sometimes happens, sometimes doesn't, but it definitely is giving this one extra momentum, particularly with the people she's against. If Cody Hart hadn't won for LaVian Rose, maybe she'd have a little more momentum.
If Gone Girl
hadn't won for Walk the Line.
And if Gone Girl had other nominations.
This is kind of the sole one for Gone Girl, isn't it? I mean, so,
shockingly, it's the only one.
Yeah,
and Felicity Jones is probably too young.
And this is a pretty solid category. I mean, I know there's a lot of talk last year. Just stupid, stupid, idiotic talk that it was not a good year for actresses. That's foolish conversation. I mean, I like Felicity Jones in theory, everything. I don't love her. But these other four performances are fantastic. And you could easily add another 10 or 11 that would just totally round out the field even more.
And Felicity Jones would be my pick to win if I could have my personal pick.
Oh, really?
Here we
you
go.
Would pick Felicity
Jones. I think she's the best thing in that film.
By the way, yeah, the theory of everything doesn't work without her.
Mm-hmm. I agree.
Right there, step by step.
Well, she kind of wrote the... Or, I mean, not she,
does
but
Gone Girl work without Rosamund Pike?
Absolutely not. And she would be... Okay. My pick, Rosamund Pike,
and that was
Gone Girl.
Adam, where are you sitting at?
I was going to say Rosamund Pike because I think her having met some creepy women in my life.
Go on,
she's right in there as like, whoa! Did she nail that?
She's phenomenal in Gone Girl.
Give it to Cody Hart again, please.
Okay. Yeah. All right, actor in a leading role: Steve Carell for Foxcatcher, Bradley Cooper, American Sniper, Benedict Cumberbatch in The Imitation Game, Michael Keaton for Birdman, and Eddie Redmayne, Theory of Everything.
You might want to go around the table on this one.
This category breaks the ballot.
I mean, Mike, where are you hitting at for this, for who you think will win?
Who do I think will win?
Who are you predicting?
I am going to predict through a clenched teeth Eddie Redmayne. Hmm. And I'm not convincing myself of that, but I will go with Eddie Redmayne.
I'm in the same camp myself.
Wow, are we all going to go the same way?
Because okay.
It's hard to do, but I am going to say Eddie Redmayne is going
to
win.
And they don't like to give it to actors young.
But they like to give it to actors young when they play Daniel Day-Lewis, My Left Foot.
Is there any chance we're getting this alleged split between Keaton and Redmayne and Cooper's coming up?
If there is a split between Michael Keaton and Eddie Redmayne, then Bradley Cooper is going
to
win.
I would like Bradley Cooper to win it. I'm not a huge fan of that movie. But
it's his best performance.
I personally didn't like probably a single Bradley Cooper performance until American Hustle. I've kind of been skeptical on him, but he is really fantastic in this movie.
Yeah. I agree.
Yeah. If I had my choice, I would give it to Michael Keaton, purely because I feel like the story of Birdman, and while it's not autobiographical for him, it just seems so fitting, and his performance and the way he just pulls everything off just really spoke to me. But I would say the Academy is going to give it to Eddie Redmayne.
Honestly, both of them are worthy. Mm-hmm. It's such a tough call. I wouldn't want to be the deciding vote on that ballot for sure.
Yeah. So best director, looking to Birdman, we've got Alejandro. How do we say that?
Iñárritu.
Alejandro Iñárritu for Birdman. Also Boyhood from Richard Linklater. Foxcatcher, Bennett Miller. The Grand Budapest Hotel with Wes Anderson as director. And The Imitation Game with Morton Tilden. These are our choices. What do you guys think? Academy taking which one?
Who's predicting this? Who's predicting a picture director split?
I'm predicting the split. I think Linklater will get the split. Seems to be happening a lot lately. I do think Linklater will get it, and whether it's just they want to give the movie another big reward, or if it's the length of the thing, or whatever.
The Boyhood film for Linklater, I think there is love for it. I know it's been subject to a huge backlash. Some of it just absurd, terrible politics. Mm-hmm. But, you know, the split has been different. It's gotten more common in the last few years. I have no idea what's going to happen here. I could
make a prediction.
All right.
You're picking Tilden.
Oh, he doesn't deserve to be there.
Not even close.
Richard Linklater will win director for Boyhood. Uh-huh. That's my prediction.
Adam, who would you like to see win, Adam?
I would rather see Alejandro win out of this. Mm. purely out of the fact that his sense of creativity, his sense of artistic direction, his sense of the spiritual that he brings to the film is something that I don't feel with of the others.
So are you predicting Alejandro for Birdman, or are you predicting Linklater for Boyhood?
No, I'm predicting Linklater for Boyhood, but I would say I want Alejandro to get
it. I guess I'm going to be the lone voice here and say, I'm predicting, based on everything that has happened as far as our precursor awards go, I am predicting Iñárritu to win for Birdman.
It happened.
I hope you're right. Hey, I really hope you're right.
I will point out there's an interesting Oscar fact, though, for this year in that Bennett Miller getting nominated for Foxcatcher, it's the first time since Angels with Dirty Faces, which was all the way back in...
Yeah, what year was that?
I know, right? I
mean, come on.
It was 1938, right?
So the 1939 Academy Awards, that means Angels with Dirty Faces was made in 1938. The last time that there were up to 10 nominees in the Best Picture category, that a director was nominated for a film that was not nominated for Best Picture... Michael Curtiz for Angels with Dirty Faces in 1939.
I remember it just like it was yesterday.
There's a weird Oscar tidbit for you and how that happened. And don't get me wrong, I love Foxcatcher, but how a movie in this day and age when up to 10 nominees gets nominated for Best Director and not Best Picture, I don't get at all.
Right. I'd say it was because Steve Carell, but they nominated him.
They nominated him.
A bit of a mix on director, but let's talk Best Picture here, because when we get right down to it, we've got American Sniper, Birdman, Boyhood, The Grand Budapest Hotel, Whiplash, The Theory of Everything, Selma, and The Imitation Game all on the plate. A lot on here.
So,
but who do we think the Academy is actually going to give it to?
Birdman. Maybe I'm putting too much. I probably am on the whole DGA, PGA... Screen Actors Guild, PGA.
DGA. WGA.
We're in anagram hell.
Many anagrams.
So, hold on. PGA is Producers Guild. The DGA is Directors Guild. The SAG is the Screen Actors Guild.
WGA is the Writers Guild.
I think it just has, whatever it is, it's got the momentum. It's a movie that's very actory in a way that Boyhood is in its lead. You know, nobody knows who Ella Coltrane is, really, other than the fact that he's tied to this.
Make a pick.
Yeah.
I'm picking Birdman for sure. I'm confident. I have confidence.
Mike, make a pick.
Lock of the week.
Pick.
I will pick Birdman. I think if it goes Birdman or Boyhood, those are bold choices for this Academy to make in either event. Yeah,
Sarah,
I agree.
Birdman is going to win, which I don't have a problem with. I shouldn't have a problem with it. It was number 5 on my top 10 for last year, so Birdman winning shouldn't bother me in the slightest. So yeah. Birdman wins.
Bothers me.
Well, it doesn't bother me at all. I hope it's Birdman. I want it to be Birdman. I also understand that Boyhood could be one of those films that also makes that come from behind. So
I would love it if somehow Grand Budapest snuck in. It's got so many nominations.
Well, tied with Birdman.
There is a scenario that either Grand Budapest Hotel or American Sniper, one of those two, and it would only be one of those two, could sneak in and take Best Picture. And the reason has everything to do with the preferential balloting system, voting system.
You want to explain that to people who might not know what that is?
So basically, you list all 8 of the films, 1 through 8 on your ballot, and you have to get 51% to win. And if you don't have 51%, the film that's last, all of their ballots get thrown out. So say they go through the first round of voting and Selma is last.
Of course you pick Selma.
Well, it's only got 2 nominations. And I
like those t-shirts.
As much as I want it to win.
I can't breathe right now.
So what happens then is that all of the Selma ballots get thrown out. And what was at number 2 on the Selma ballot becomes number 1. So now everything gets counted again, and everything falls down one spot.
This sounds more confusing than an Iraqi election.
It is more confusing.
I swear.
But the way that a film can sneak through is when you're looking at Birdman and you're looking at Boyhood, in some ways those films are polarizing to certain segments of the Academy.
Sure.
And so you imagine that the people that love it, love it. Yeah. And so it's going to end up at the number 1 or number 2 line if you're talking Birdman and Boyhood. They're going to be on a lot of number 1 and number 2 lines on a lot of people's ballots.
Sure.
But because those films are so polarizing, they're also going to be on a lot of 7 and a lot of 8 lines on a lot of people's ballots. The Grand Budapest Hotel, American Sniper, they're hard movies for Academy members to hate. Right. And so you could so you could foresee a scenario where those two films are on everybody's number three line.
And makes a come from behind.
If you are on the number three line and you have enough number one lines and you have a year where the voting gets split, you win. And suddenly your chariot's afire.
Yeah.
So Adam, you want Birdman?
I want Birdman to win. Sarah? Again. Yeah. It's
I want Boyhood to win. Boyhood? But I'm happy with Birdman winning. Again, it was number five on my top ten.
Where you said, Mike?
Those are the top two films I had in my top 10 list. Boyhood was my number one, Birdman number two. I'm happy with either one.
Would that be the case with Selma? I know you didn't see Selma until after
Selma
the
is,
New Year.
Is in the conversation.
I would love Selma to win. Selma and Grand Budapest Hotel would
pull him for Budapest.
Real quick, I just want to mention Whiplash, which no one has seen still. Mm-hmm. It's only made $10 million. Sony Pictures Classics should be drawn and quartered for how they've handled that movie.
The Blu-ray comes out next week.
Whiplash could sneak in and win two or three Oscars. Easily. And that will knock everybody for a loop. So I'm just putting that out there.
Could happen. So those are the top picks that we've got in store for us this week. Talking a little bit about what else we got going on. Sarah, you've got some interesting stuff you've been writing about this week.
Well, in the Seattle Gay News this week, I have an article with Greg Wood. He's the operations manager over at Seattle's iconic Cinerama Theater. We're talking about their recent restoration, but we're really talking about their upcoming Fists of Fury mixed martial arts film festival with a new 35 millimeter print of The Seven Samurai.
Yeah!
Plus all but one. So four of the five Bruce Lee movies.
Oh, brilliant.
Okay.
Nice.
Brilliant. Local legend.
Mike, anything at shouldiseeit.net that you're working on?
At this point, just movie reviews. I also contribute box office and Oscar reporting for awardcircuit.com. So you can find some extra work over there, but I'm just trying to get in as many movies as I can.
Yeah. And nice. Brian, how about you?
I'm going to have a review up of What We Do in the Shadows, and I'm running a Kevin Smith marathon on my Zitzel Film blog, where I'm going through to figure out, were any of these movies that I loved deeply, deeply as a high schooler any good? Was it purely that, like, I was just a comic book nerd hoping to hear anybody mention Mad Men? Next week is Dogma.
Kevin Smith,
I think it's about to take a turn for the worse.
Oh, boy. All right. So, in summation for this evening, films out in theaters this week, we had three solid theater votes for McFarland, USA, Splitting the Fence on Hot Tub Time Machine 2, one in the theater, one in the rental category, two for What We Do in the Shadows in the theater, and for The Duff, we had a solid three votes for rental this week. This is Cinema Squabble. You can check us out again at cinemasquabble.com throughout the week, and if you want to catch up on what we're writing and to learn a little bit more about your hosts here, you can check us out at cinemasquabble.com. Just click on the Your Hosts link, and that'll take you right to all our Twitter information, our various different web pages, get you the information you need to know.
So hashtag again, Adam Rides the Fence.
We'll see about that. We'll see about that next time, oh Zitzel Film.
What's coming up next time, Adam? Are we going to do the second best exotic marigold hotel in Chappie?
I sure hope sort of.
Short not. Circuit, the remake. Yeah, more blood.
How Johnny many words are in that alive. Title? The second best, third, fourth exotic
the
marigold?
The second best exotic marigold hotel.
Oh, it just rolls off the tongue.
Yeah. And I think
sweet.
We'll
probably... The new batch.
We'll also have probably a few words to talk about what just happened in the Oscars when we return. So
this Sunday.
Yeah,
tune in, ABC.
Indeed. So we will catch you next time. Again, thanks for post-production from Squawking Vulture Studios from the post-post-production of this production. And thanks again to Sprint's Arbogast, our producer, for the evening.